The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, it was a fantastic discovery by a man devoted to discovering just such a work. The year is 1817, and a man named Hanka is visiting his home region. He's a Czech writer, pushing his fellow Czechs to shake off the influence of Germany and Germanic literature, and to return to their Czech roots, including writing in the Czech language. And lo and behold, he finds in the vault of a church a manuscript written in Old Czech, with fragments of a literary poem dating back several centuries, infused with what he called a truly Homeric spirit. Aha! Here is a rock upon which a history of Czech literature, and indeed a people's sense of national identity, can be founded. Only one question remained. Was this manuscript real? Was it forged? And when others were found, the same question arose. And the more popular and successful these manuscripts became, pointing the Czech people toward a new sense of pride and nationhood, the louder those questions loomed. What if these weren't real? What then? We talked to author David Cooper, professor of Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, about the Czech manuscripts today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you to everyone who has signed up to be a patron at patreon.com/literature. That's a small monthly contribution. Or to everyone who has donated to the show at historyofliterature.com/donate. I love you all. You are truly angels here on earth. Now, let's get right to it. It's snowing like crazy as I record this here in Washington, D.C., or the outskirts thereof, and I'm cold, and I can't wait to get out of this drafty studio and into a hot toddy. Well, I don't drink those, but you know what I mean. Under the big blanket in front of the fire, watching a little something-something on television. You should check out the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune, by the way. That's Jodorowsky with a J, J-O-D-O. We're going to have an episode on Jodorowsky coming up soon, and his film is a delight. This film, I mean, the documentary about the making of... Well, Jodorowsky is quite a guy. He attempted to make what would have been the greatest, most ambitious science fiction movie of all time. And yes, I'm including 2001, A Space Odyssey. He assembled a group of spiritual warriors to be part of the filmmaking efforts, including artists like H.R. Giger and Moebius, and then actors like Mick Jagger and Orson Welles and Salvador Dali and many others. And well, you'll see for yourself. The interviews with Jodorowsky are a delight. He's a great spirit. And his ambition for this thing, which was to change the consciousness of the world, is infectious. It's available on some streaming services here in the States. It's on Max. So that gives you a little prep work. But if you don't get to it, that's fine too. We'll have everything you need in our episode, as we do today. David Cooper has been researching and writing about the Czech manuscripts, so let's bring him out to explain all of that, the little corner of literary history, and then we'll have a My Last Book with Jesse Cavadlo, our Don DeLillo expert. Will he choose one of Don DeLillo's books to be the last book he will ever read? We will see. But first, David Cooper. Okay, joining me now is David L. Cooper, who is Associate Professor of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Illinois. He's also the author of Creating the Nation, Identity and Aesthetics in Early 19th Century Russia and Bohemia. He's here today to discuss his new book, The Czech Manuscripts, Forgery, Translation, and National Myth. David Cooper, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So there's a forgery we're going to be talking about today, and I think a lot of people will maybe be a little bit familiar with the Ossianic poems, and I think there are some similarities here. So maybe we should start with that. Who was Ossian, and what did those poems do for Scottish literature?
Yeah, so the Poems of Ossian were first published by James McPherson in 1760, and Ossian was the traditional author of the poems. So he was both a warrior and a bard, supposedly from the third century, and a lot of the Scottish oral tradition songs were attributed to him. Mm-hmm. And so McPherson, under some desire and requests from some literary patrons, produced a translation of some of this material into English, or at least it was presented as a translation and presented as a literal translation of these sorts of ancient songs, or songs that had roots in an ancient period. Right. But in fact, they weren't really translations at all in a certain sense.
Right. McPherson had kind of made this up, we think.
To a certain degree. I mean, yeah. So he's drawing on, there were like real traditions, right? And there were real songs that were in Ossian's voice, you know, within the tradition. But he saw the existing tradition as having been corrupted. For one thing, there's lots of references to Christianity and appeals to St. Patrick in the songs. And of course, if these songs have their origin in the area, in the period before Christianization of the Scots, then he saw that as a later sort of accretion. And so when he translates it, or when he adapts this material for the English-speaking audience, he eliminates that, right? So he's, in some sense, his crime is not the fabrication from nothing of the poetry, but the sort of attempt to restore what he imagined to be the ancient sort of original form that poetry must have had.
Mm-hmm. And these were a sensation, an international sensation. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, Napoleon, Thoreau, there's all of these luminaries who were really taken by this, and they seem to have viewed Ossian as a kind of Homer, and that Scottish national mythology was kind of like something you would find in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Exactly. So the analogy with the Greek literary tradition was really important. So Ossian sort of occupies that place of the original poet and the founder of the what they're starting to talk about in this period as national tradition, right? So literature wasn't necessarily seen as limited or sort of defined by its national characteristics in, you know, the 17th century and for part of the 18th century. But actually the Scots are sort of in the forefront of starting to think about literature as a product of national culture. And so the analogy Greeks then sort of become the original nation in this, in terms of literature. And they provide us, you know, our genres of epic poetry and tragedy and comedy and lyric poetry and all these kinds of things. And so, yeah, then you need to find that. So what are the roots of your national tradition? And then for the Scots, of course, it became Ossian. And yeah, it was hugely popular for like a century and a half. It was sort of read and imitated all over Europe. In fact, I was doing a bike tour in August this year in Northeast Iowa, and I made sure that I made a stop in the town of Ossian, Iowa, along the trip just to mark it, you know. So
yeah.
People name their children after characters from the poetry. So
right. And just to, I mean, often literature, I think, can be viewed as kind of an idle pastime or an artistic, you know, sort of a hobby, or, you know, something that just colors life a little bit. But here we're talking about people who will say, well, you know, this is like, ignore the current borders or ignore what you know about the geopolitical world today. We are a people. We go back far. We have roots, and there's something very important about who we were and how long we've been, you know, in that category. And we have accomplishments and achievements that can go back centuries that define us and shape who we understand ourselves to be.
Yes. It's a very, the way that, developing romanticism conceives of national culture, right? It's very mm-hmm. concerned with origins. Origins are defining, right? And they see the origins, again, on analogy with Greeks, in epic poetry, in these songs about mm-hmm. the battles, right?
Yeah.
That formed the national community. And so that's true for the Scottish material McPherson publishes, recreates. In some sense, here he's really taking a small amount of material and extrapolating greatly from it. He creates the epic Fingal, right? That's based, that draws on these songs where Fingal was a hero and there were battle songs, and he turns it into a longer coherent narrative in an epic length poem.
Okay, so let's move over a few hundred miles, I guess, to the east,
right.
To the Queen's Court and Green Mountain manuscripts. What were those?
So those were a pair of manuscripts, and there were actually a few other small, less significant manuscripts with just like a page of poetry or fragments of poems that were found around the same time. These were discovered in the second decade of the 19th century in 1817 and 1818, and they had epic poetry. They had these songs of the ancient battles of the Czechs driving out, for example, a Polish occupation of Prague or an invasion of the Tartars from the east as the Tartars were coming and sort of dominating Europe, along with some folk songs, some love songs, and other shorter sort of poetic forms.
And when did these come to light?
So it's again, the end of the second decade of the 19th century, 1818, 1817.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's worth noting that this is the period when, in some ways, the Ossianic material was at its height of popularity. The number of editions that were released, translations and copies of the Ossianic poetry, was highest in the first couple of decades of the 19th century. So Europe is sort of awash in this material at this moment.
Right. And how were these presented to the public? Were these also presented as translations from a more archaic form of the language, or how did that work?
Yeah, in that way, they're quite different, actually, from ASEAN. So there's a lot of similarities in terms of the type of poetry and, you know, the appeal to sort of origins of national tradition. But these were presented actually as ancient manuscripts, right, in the original Old Czech language.
Oh, right.
Which at that point in time, because the Czechs are coming out of a counter-reformation in which Czech had been seen as a language of heresy and sort of suppressed, and Czechs are all being educated in German in their schools, there's very, very few people, a handful of people at best, who can read this old Czech language.
Mm-hmm.
And so they manufactured, they took old parchment, they scraped off Latin texts, and they wrote these new old texts over top of them and presented them as, you know, sort of one was supposed to come from sort of the 13th, maybe early 14th century. The other one, by its writing forms and its language forms, suggested it came from maybe the 9th or 10th century, which would have pushed back, you know, the date of the first writing we see in Czech by a couple of centuries. It was really quite spectacularly bold.
Right. My son once had to do a school project where he had to come up with an ancient document. And I think we soaked a piece of paper in tea or something and baked it in the oven for a while. And we got a nice, good, yellowish, crispy looking page. And he did quite well on his assignment. I don't think he fooled his teacher, but he got a good grade. And I know forgers who do this with wine labels and who do it with art. And I mean, they can be very convincing when they use, I think some paintings will use old canvases and maybe even old paints that they have access to in order to try to trick people. So, okay. So let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and find out how all this happened and how it was received. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, we're back with David L. Cooper. So, David, who was Václav Hanka and what role did he play in this?
Václav Hanka is our prime suspect in the conspiracy for the forging of these manuscripts.
Yeah.
At the time when they appeared, he was a young man just out of university, and he was a Czech nationalist. He'd actually been teaching some classes in Czech language at the university, and he'd been studying with the leading expert of the day on Old Czech and Old Slavic language, Josef Dobrovský. Was his tutor along with his roommate, Josef Linda. And so the two of them, when the second manuscript appeared, when the Green Mountain manuscript appeared and suggested, you know, Czech writing back in the 9th and 10th century, Dobrovský, this sort of went against everything that he knew about, you know, old Czech writing traditions. And he sort of immediately said, I don't believe it. And I know who did it. And it's my students. because they know enough of the language to fake it.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's interesting. Boy, in the, I don't know if you've ever seen the Alfred Hitchcock movie Rope.
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. So that's one where it's based on a kind of Leopold and Loeb story of a couple of college students who decide to murder somebody. And then Jimmy Stewart plays their professor who comes over for dinner and is immediately suspicious of how they're acting and whether they've taken all of these ideas that he's given them a little too seriously. And it sounds like we would have a very interesting movie to have Dobrovský read this and think, oh no, I was on board with what they were doing when I thought it was legitimate, but they've taken things a step too far. So
yeah,
maybe we should talk a little bit about the Czech National Revival and exactly how these manuscripts fit into that. Were they kind of fighting for their lives from a national perspective? Was this, how essential was it for them to be able to say, well, we actually have a much longer history with much more elaborate or much more artistically sound than has been understood before?
It was really crucial. If you look at the private correspondence of sort of the leading Czech national revivalists of the, in the first and second decade of the 19th century, you know, it's like a handful, two handfuls at most of people who are talking to each other and they're trying, they have this program for reviving Czech as a language of education, right? As a scientific language, as a language of literature, as a way of, sort of reviving. They thought, their idea of nationalism and it's typical of the period is that it's existed back into antiquity, right? And it's sort of been lost because, we've been colonized by German-speaking people. And so we need to revive it. And so their attempts to do that, they didn't have any sense that their project, there was no guarantee for their project. They talked sometimes quite pessimistically about whether the outcome would be positive, whether they'd be able to sort of recreate a sort of living Czech national culture. And I think that, not that it wouldn't have happened without the manuscripts, but the manuscripts were certainly a very important part of what happened, right? And what enabled them to recruit people to the cause, to tell people. So you're being educated in German, and German culture has gone through this tremendous renaissance in the late 18th century and into the 19th century. It's kind of the leading literature in Europe, right? Schiller and Goethe are idols to everyone.
Yeah.
And so how do you convince people, no, you should be writing your poetry in Czech rather than in German, and you should be trying to write your scientific articles in Czech rather than in German? It seems silly because there's so few people actually that can read it. In the villages outside the cities, they speak Czech, but they're not learning to read and write it, right? And so this comes along, and teachers in the schools sort of hand it to their students to read outside of class and say, hey, you know, we're reading this German material, but look, we Czechs had something too.
Right, right. You can imagine that people who, before they would have an example like that handy, would be kind of saying, well, okay, Czech is fine that people are speaking it, but boy, this is, you know, it's not a language for the educated people, or it's not fit to be it's not a worthy kind of worldwide scale language because it doesn't have a Goethe, it doesn't have a Schiller. I'm sure people would make that argument using Shakespeare or, you know, the kind of traditions that English has if they were faced with a similar situation in the UK or the US.
Yes. Yeah. It's not the best poetry that was written in the first half of the 19th century in Czech, but it's up there. It's high quality, and it's presented as folk poetry, right? So the fact that it's a little bit more simple and it has a sort of repetitive diction, that's how it's supposed to be, right? And mm-hmm. So it was quite effective. So like the closest analog and the material that they were probably copying most closely was folk songs that were being collected and published in the second decade of the 19th century by the Serbian nationalist Vuk Karadzic. He was publishing these South Slavic epic poems, and everyone in Europe, they were a sensation as well. Everyone in Europe was reading them and comparing them to Ossian, right? Comparing them to the German Nibelungenlied, right? And these kinds of things. And so the Czechs were desperately searching through their archives, right, for this kind of material, and they weren't finding it. And so I think Hanka and his collaborators recreated it, and they used that South Slavic material as an important sort of related Slavic model that they copy mm-hmm. and imitate.
Now, were Hanka and others aware that we know of the example of Ossian?
They most certainly were. Like I said earlier, it's you know, it's sort of at its height of its popularity. At this moment in the early 19th century, there were a number of German translations already. And in fact, one of the translators, Michael Dennis, who translated it in the late 1760s, not that long after it was first published, translated it into German. In his introduction to the material, says, the Slavs, it seems, must have some similar kinds of material to this. I wonder why we haven't seen it yet. Right. And so this sort of impetus to let's go look for it. And if we don't find it, maybe we can recreate it as well.
Yeah. How were they received? You mentioned some teachers who would give them to students kind of outside of class, but were they bestsellers, or how well did they do in both within and around the world?
So the skeptical reaction of Dobrovsky was an obstacle to the Green Mountain manuscript for a number of years until there was a sort of scholarly refutation of his doubts. But he never doubted the first manuscript. He never doubted the Queen's Court manuscript. But it takes a while for the momentum to build. Fairly early on, there's some musical settings that are composed for the lyrical songs, but the cult of the manuscripts, and there's a cult that definitely develops, sort of takes off with the development of the Czech national movement. So it's only in the 1840s that it starts to become a mass movement where you really have large numbers of people who start to be educated in Czech and start to, you know, publish things in Czech. And it's when that movement gets going that these manuscripts sort of take on a sort of sacred status as the sort of founding documents. And they, at this point, they do become a bestseller. There's edition after edition after edition that's coming out in the middle of the 19th century of these poems. And again, no one can still read them, right? They're still written in this older form of Czech that has a really different verb system. All of the narrative past tense forms of verbs in old Czech are different from modern Czech. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of unrecognizable and unreadable in a basic way. But they're always published with German translation, modern Czech translation. And by the middle of the century, they'd also been translated into French, into English, into Italian, and into a bunch of other Slavic languages as well.
And can we measure any, geopolitical impact in terms of, was it cited by artists around the world or by politicians anywhere or anything to sort of say, look, this is, you know, kind of in the way that ASEAN was?
Yeah, no, not to that degree. It didn't reach that sort of height of popularity as ASEAN, because the sort of, by the time it starts to circulate, ASEAN is also sort of on the decline in the second half of the 19th century. There's this new sort of rise of positivism, right, that starts to bring skepticism towards these kinds of things. So I found articles published in American literary magazines that are basically plagiarized articles out of British magazines. And so, you know, there was discussion, but I think they remained, you know, sort of on the periphery. If you were interested in Europe and the Slavs, then you might know about them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they were never the sort of big phenomenon that ASEAN was.
Right. So it must have been something, though, as they grew in popularity. You can imagine that the people whoever forged it would have been thinking, or maybe I should say fabricated it, the people would be thinking, well, on the one hand, it's great. This is what we were hoping for, to get this widespread audience for these and to see it being read and the way it's changing people's minds, but also thinking, what if this all gets exposed? It's going to be worse. You know, if something is becoming more and more important to the Czech people, you know, then you're really going to pull the rug out from under them if it comes out that these are hoaxes.
Yes, exactly. I've often wondered if they didn't do it as, you know, a little bit of a prank at some level to see if people would buy it. But then once people buy it, how do you retract it without doing damage? Right. And especially as the years go by. So actually, in the year is like 1859 or something like that, there's a German language newspaper in Prague that publishes a series of articles about literary forgeries. And the last article accuses Hanke of forging Queen's Court and Green Mountain manuscripts. There were reasons already by that point, sorts of, that some of these other smaller things that had been discovered, and all of these discoveries happened around Hanke and his friends, that had already come under skepticism and had been shown to maybe be false. And so there's this moment of doubt, and Hanke actually had to be pushed by other leading, you know, nationalists and patriots to sue the newspaper for libel for having accused him of forging it. He seemed reluctant, right? So, you know, I mean, he knows they're right, probably, you
right,
know?
And right. So,
but he does sue, and he sues successfully, because partly because the person suing gets to frame the way that the question is investigated. And it was framed around the question of, did he discover manuscripts, right? And so it goes back to, you know, this whole staged moment where he goes into a church in Dvor Kraljeve in Eastern Bohemia with witnesses along, and suddenly there's this manuscript in his hands, and there were eyewitnesses to the fact that, you know, he sort of found it in this vault, in this church, and got permission from the church to take it away and send it to the National Museum, right? And so that's what was investigated, not any sort of, you know, literary critical examinations of the authenticity of the manuscripts, and was the language right, which it's not quite, and that kind of thing. So
yeah.
So he wins the lawsuit.
Right.
And then,
wow.
And then dies like a year later, actually. So he gets this massive funeral celebration and a burial at a site that's starting to become sort of the resting place of famous national patriots and this kind of thing. So he dies a hero, really.
Yeah. And he had been the librarian of the Czech National Museum.
Yes.
Right.
A job that he likely got because he made the donation of this major manuscript to the museum. Right. And a job that then got him access to all kinds of other older manuscripts.
Right.
And he did some good work in terms of uncovering old things, but he also did some good work in terms of fabricating new old things where he's writing in the margins and in between lines in genuine Latin manuscripts, you know, new ancient Czech translations from the Latin into Czech and this kind of thing.
Right. I guess because of his death, he was spared the whatever the equivalent was of appearing on Oprah and confessing all of his sins and and his remorse. So what's the current scholarly consensus? I understand we believe that they were fabricated, but we're not positive it was Hanke. Or where do things stand now?
So there's never been discovered any sort of smoking gun, any sort of correspondence or rough drafts or any of these kinds of things that would be sufficient to serve as a you know, here we go. We've got hard, you know, concrete material evidence of the fabrication. The evidence is circumstantial, but it's so much circumstantial evidence at this point that there's really no question that Hanke was involved, that his roommate Josef Linde was involved, probably his friend who was an art restorer was involved in the fabrication of the material manuscripts, right? And there were others probably who were in on it who maybe weren't, you know, involved in writing the poetry or producing the manuscripts. So, and it's all based on, well, for one thing, the language isn't quite correct old Czech. So these, again, the verb forms, they'd gone out. Old Czech had an aorist and an imperfect verb form that were used for narration of these events. And the modern Czech doesn't have those verb forms. And Hanke doesn't quite get them right. And he sometimes uses the wrong one in the wrong situation, right? And there's other things, too, where they're imitating, because they're imitating Russian and Serbian folk materials, they sometimes use things that grammatically are closer to Russian and Serbian than they are to Old Czech. For example, the basic and conjunction, there's two. There's a and there's e. And modern Czech and old Czech use a with a much greater frequency than e. And e has its very specialized sort of narrow usage. They're using e about 10 times more often than a. And that doesn't correspond to any other old Czech writing. So these kinds of problems were initially, like, linguists in the sort of middle 19th century that were studying old Czech were sort of making exception, right? There's these kinds of documents, and there's these that come from the oral tradition, and the language seems to be a little bit different. And at some point, you have enough exceptions and enough sort of a big body of material versus this small body of material, and the linguists are finally saying, actually, maybe this stuff is just not genuine.
Yeah. And you mentioned this before, I think, but just to tease this out a little bit, Hanke had also been caught didn't he alter some manuscripts or something? Or there were other incidents that kind of cast some doubt on his reliability.
Exactly. Yeah. So, for example, he came in 1849 to the board of the National Museum with a new discovery that was sort of a continuation of one of the poems, the one from the Green Mountain manuscript. It was the legend of the founding of the Czech dynasty, and it was the prophecy of this princess Libuše. It was a genuine Latin manuscript that he had found in the National Museum and had it published. And then suddenly he finds also a Czech version of it. And at that point, I mean, there had been enough sort of doubts around him that the board sort of looked at each other and said, no, this is a step too far.
So it's like, here's a Latin manuscript I have. And if you give me about 6 weeks, I'll find one in Czech too.
Exactly.
Okay, so are these Czech manuscripts, are they worth reading today, or is this of interest as a literary and historical phenomenon?
I hope they're worth reading today, because I've also published a translated edition into English of the songs with Michigan Slavic Publications. And that came out in sort of the end of 2019, so just before the pandemic, and didn't have a lot of chance to promote it. But I think they are worth reading. I mean, if people are still reading the South Slavic songs collected by Karadzic, it's sort of a, you know, it's not, again, mass popular kind of interest. But if you're interested in folk traditions, and if you're interested in these kinds of old poetry and poetry imitations, right, they're really not bad.
Right. Okay, yeah.
They're quite readable. They're interesting stories, right? And because they have this whole aura of the scandal of their fabrication around them, it's really, you know, it's fun to read them and think about how they were being read when everyone thought they were the real thing.
Right. Okay. So you answered a better question than I asked. I should have asked it not as if they're worth reading, but in reading them, are you getting something other than, I mean, it would be fun to read it to say, well, this is the thing that fooled everybody, but it would also be nice if the stories were good or there was some artistic merit to it that made them of interest even. And that's what I was wondering, if they had continued that kind of appeal, or if they really were just something to read as a curiosity of this hoax.
Yeah, I do think they still have a readerly appeal.
Okay,
that makes them, you know, and it's not a huge amount of material, really. And so it's, you know, you could do it in an afternoon, sit down and read through them, and it would, and it's enjoyable.
Yeah. And people, I mean, we have a lot to compare it with. We have the Scottish examples we talked about, or Robert Burns. When you were describing it before, it kind of reminded me of Robert Burns. Or you could compare it with other folk tales and songs and stories of that ilk as well, and kind of see it from a different perspective. So would you say this incident, does it tell us anything about readers and writers, or about European history, or how do you make sense of this incident and give it whatever importance that it has?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the form that they took tells us a lot about what people wanted in, you know, the second decade of the 19th century, what they were looking for, what was going to be most useful for a reviving national literary culture, right? I mean, I think they hit that like square on the head of the nail. The fact that it became such a phenomenon before, I mean, it's not really exposed until the 1880s, finally, and quite sort of slowly and reluctantly among, you know, Czech patriotic circles. And it tells us a lot about how they conceived of national culture, right? And it's, I think it's different from how we conceive culture today. We conceive culture as not having such well-defined borders, as being sort of more porous. And we understand that cultural creativity often takes the form of cultural interchange with other places. But the romantic nationalist perspective is very invested in our own national originality, and it has to be ours, and it has to be unique and different and belong only to us. And I think that was hard for them to give up, right?
Yeah.
This sort of represented that to them, and it was very hard to give that up.
Yeah. Well, you can see that kind of anxiety. I mean, I'm just doing some, I just did an episode on Washington Irving, and you could see that anxiety in America of the day of, you know, we have to be able to produce writers that are not just translations of European writers, or are not just imported from the UK. Like, if we're going to be a real place, a real nation, we've got to have some writers of our own who can compete on that level. Or, you know, I'm thinking of today in Canada, where they have a certain percentage of what we broadcast has to be Canadian. It can't just be all shows from Hollywood and from the US. And a feeling that you kind of have to define yourself through your storytelling and through your art if you're going to be able to stand on your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that it's a narrow view of literature, it's a narrow view of creativity, right? I mean, it's functional for nationalist purposes, but I think we all have good reason to be skeptical about certain aspects of nationalist purposes. I mean, one of the groups that in the early 20th century, after the scholarly community had certainly decided that these were fakes, that were promoting them still as genuine, was the Czech fascist movement in the 1930s, right? Because again, they're sort of their narrow conception of nationalism and the need to have your own sort of thing that you can trumpet around, the manuscripts still could serve that.
Yeah. And what you're really doing is, in the case of Hanka, is to show that you're capable of a hoax. And in the case of the fascists, that you're saying, don't believe what your eyes tell you, just listen to us and don't doubt, and, you know, go along with what the authority is presenting, because we will believe what we want to believe, not what is necessarily true.
Right.
Okay. Well, that was fascinating. David Cooper, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
It's been a pleasure.
Good stuff from David Cooper. And to top things off today, let's hear from Jesse Cavadlo, a professor and president of the Don DeLillo Society. After I talked to him about the works of Don DeLillo, I asked him this special question. Okay, we're joined now by Jesse Cavadlo, president of the Don DeLillo Society and editor of the book Don DeLillo in Context. Jesse, this question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
There are a whole bunch of books that I've read and reread lots of times, so it's tempting to pick one of those, you know, kind of comfort books. So Don DeLillo's White Noise is a great example. I've read that book more than any other. I've also read Michael Chabon's The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay many times. And considering that it's a 600-plus page novel, each time I go into it, it's not a small thing. I've read Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad a lot of times. And each time I read it, I feel like I get more and more connections. But I think in terms of this last book, I would probably go with something almost thematically having to do with last, as opposed to something that I've simply read before or found comforting. I would probably have to go with the essays of the philosopher Walter Benjamin, that he was very interested in something like ends of things, the purposes of stories, death, the way in which technology interfaces with the world. It feels like if I were going to end on something, it would probably be the way in which Walter Benjamin was understanding the world. He also wrote these in this kind of Holocaust context. So in many ways, the world was ending for him right around that time. Sounds like a dark way to go out, but in some ways it is also a very clear vision of how he wants the end to be.
Mm-hmm. As that the window is closing and your world is shrinking, so to speak, but you'd be in the company of somebody who was going through something very similar and still writing at such a intellectually high level.
Exactly. That it's hard to say that other people have been through the end of the world, but some people have been, and Walter Benjamin was one of them.
Now, I found this little note in the book that you edited, Don DeLillo in Context, that Michael Cunningham was asked about the books he would bring to a desert island, and he said, well, you know what, if I had to, I could just take a single DeLillo sentence with me and read it over and over again, which I thought was really beautiful and quite a tribute to Don DeLillo, but how about that instead of a last book?
I might have to read that sentence a lot of times, but I think it would certainly work.
Okay, Jesse Cavadlo, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. That is a wrap, as they say, for this particular episode of the History of Literature. My thanks to Don DeLillo. I guess I could thank him too. Why not? Thanks to David Cooper for joining me, is what I meant to say. You can find his book on the Czech manuscripts at bookstores near you, and to Jesse Cavadlo for the cameo appearance. Walter Benjamin. We've been meaning to do an episode on Benjamin. Hopefully we'll get there soon. In the meantime, and as always, I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.